The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Anyway, I was coming home last Thursday night. And apparently my family had been trying to reach me, and I didn't realize. I got a call from my cousin in England. And all he had to say on the phone was one word, Benji. And I knew right away. You know, in this country, when you hear that kind of thing, you just sort of know. And he had been part of a very elite unit in the Israeli army called Egoz. And he was the company commander. And in Israel, you know, in every other army in the world, if you're the company commander, you're actually in the rear directing your troops. But in Israel, that's not true. If you go to officers' course, they're the base down in the south where they train officers, Badechad, there's a big slogan across the main wall of the base that you can't help but notice as you walk in. And it says, Acharai, which means, follow me. And that's a legend that was born in the Battle of Latrun, in 1948, when Israeli officers led their men into battle wave after wave against this fortress. And it has become sort of the raison d'etre of officers in Israel. And unfortunately or fortunately, it was certainly something that he lived. He was leading his men in battle, and they were hit by a mortar shell. And we lost just one of our best. He was a very, very unique boy, 27 years old. Watched him grow up. When I came to this country, we didn't have much family here, my brother and I. So we practically lived in their home, in the home of his family. He was 4 years old when he came to Israel. And had this mischievous grin. It was always ever present on his face. He used to love to sort of, you know, get into my army bags. His mother, my cousin, used to make me, you know, put the M16 and hide it away because they were afraid that he would find it. Just an incredible boy. I used to wake up on Shabbat morning with him jumping on top of my stomach because he wanted me to get the treats. And I guess most painful of all, although there are no ways to measure these things, is that I actually got a chance because of him to reconnect with the whole family, all the cousins and the children of cousins and just about everybody. About a month ago, 3 weeks before he fell at his wedding, he went out with his bride for, gosh, I don't know, for about at least 8 years. And they finally decided to get married. He had signed on for another 5 years in the army, including 2 years of studies. He was going to study just in a couple weeks when the war broke out. And I can't even begin to describe what it is to see a girl at the height of her joy, in her wedding dress, just so happy, so incredibly happy. Couldn't stop talking in the car on the way home, what a happy couple they were, what a picture book story it was, what a model, I mean, both of them, just beautiful, just unbelievable. They had a song, you know, they had broken up a couple times over the course of whatever, and they got back together, and she had this song, I think from Argentina in Spanish, that she used to listen to, so he learned it by heart. And he surprised her, you know, at a certain point the bride and groom are sitting and everybody's dancing in front of them. And he surprised her by taking the mic and going out into the middle of the dance floor and serenading her. And it was funny because he wasn't exactly a born singer and nobody thought he was going to quit his day job. But she was just like loving every minute. You could see she was so just reveling in the fact that this was now her husband and that he was stopping the show just to serenade her. And then to see her 3 weeks later, you know, prostrate over the grave of her husband, having only spent about 5 days and one Shabbat together, because he had to go up north to be with his men. Just heartbreaking. And then to visit the Shiva all week and to see his brother who just idolized him, who himself is also an officer in Golani, and where that's gonna go. It's not accidental that this period of time is a period of intense mourning for the Jewish people. In 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, We commemorated the 17th day of Tammuz. You may remember that I was just finishing a fast that Thursday. And that was the anniversary of the day the Romans broke through the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. 3 weeks later, which this year falls out next Thursday, is the 9th of Av, the day that both temples were destroyed. We've just entered yesterday with a new moon, with Rosh Chodesh, the period known as the 9 days, 9 days of intense mourning. And I have to say, more than any year I can ever remember, not at all difficult to feel the pain this year. The entire country is just trying to get a grip. We lost 9 more boys last night in very intense fighting in Birj Bel, which is a village sort of just below the hill of Marun Aras and below Kfar Nobel. And what's really difficult about this is all these names, you know, Tzur, Tzidon, Rashidia, all of these names in Beirut, in Lebanon, they're all names we know. Everybody 40 years and older, who's in the army, and they all remember these names from being in Lebanon from 1982 and 84 and 85. And to hear these names again, and to hear that your kids now are going into them, and the children of your friends who fought there, it's just a heartbreaking thing. To think that there are 9 families that today and tomorrow are burying their sons and going through that incredible hole beneath you opening up experience where life changes forever is just beyond. And more and more families are starting. You know, I was sitting in a car this morning and I was taking a drive in. And, you know, we were just talking about the war, and the guy gets a call on his phone. And all of a sudden, he starts to heave. Because he had just found out that the son of a good friend of his had been killed in action yesterday. And he starts, you know, he apologizes, and he just, you know, because I had taken a ride with him, I don't know him well, pulls over to the side of the road and just starts sobbing. Then he calls his wife, and his wife's on the speakerphone, and she starts sobbing. The two of them are crying. And so, of course, you're sitting in a car, and of course, I just went through all this a week ago, and now I'm crying, and then there's another woman in the car, and she's crying. And that's just where this country is at. Just an intensely difficult period. And I find it interesting that that this week's portion is the portion known as Dvarim. Right? The first verse in this week's portion, Deuteronomy, Dvarim. Ele ha-dvarim asher diber Moshe el kol Yisrael be'ever Erden. These are the things, these are the words that Moshe spoke to the entire Jewish people on the other side of the Jordan. This week's portion is always the portion that is read on Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. In fact, this Shabbat is called Shabbat Chazon. It's the Shabbat of vision. It's called that name because the Haftarah, the prophetic portion we read, is Chazon Yishayahu ben Amotz, the vision of Isaiah, you know, the dream that one day we won't have to mourn, that somehow this will all become part of our distant past. And I remember when they signed the Oslo Accords in 1993, and I had a lot of hesitations about that, and I was very nervous about it. But a part of me said, you know, we've taken enough risks for war. Maybe it's time to take risks for peace. And in the back of your mind, you're thinking to yourself, you know, Yonatan back then was not even a year old. Thinking, you know, maybe he won't have to do this. Maybe by the time he's 18, we won't need armies, and we won't have war. And I won't have to worry about sending him off to do the stuff that we used to do. And over the last number of years, that dream has just been shattered into pieces. And whatever was left of it, a few weeks ago, just went up in smoke with the artillery shells. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that that we don't believe that one day we'll have peace, and it doesn't mean that one day we won't, you know, be living in a land of peace here in Israel. It just means that at least on the face of things, it doesn't look good for the near future. And it's interesting that this week's portion, Ela HaDvarim, is about words. It's the words that Moshe shares with the Jewish people. And find it pretty challenging that this week, this country is struggling to deal with those matters for which there are no words. You know? How do you deal with this? And it's interesting that that the first mention that we find of Tisha B'Av, of the ninth day of Av, is alluded to in the Torah, and the Midrash picks up on this, the rabbinic legend. It says that when the spies came back from their mission, back in the portion of Shlach, after 40 days of spying out the land, they come back, they talk about the fact that we'll never be able to make it in. Kalev and Yeshua, the two spies who think that they're mistaken, argue with them. The Jewish people begin to cry. Vayivku balailahu, and they cried on that night. So the Midrash notes this verse. What does it mean, and they cried on that night? It should just say they cried. So Rashi brings down the rabbinic legend, the Midrash, that says, Atem bachitem b'chiya shel chinam. You cried tears for no reason. Eten lachem b'chiya shel mamash. I will give you a reason to cry. And that night, according to rabbinic tradition, was the 9th of Av. Now this raises a number of questions. First of all, it means that the roots, from a rabbinic perspective, of the destruction of the temple of the 9th of Av are hidden in the story of the spies. If the crying of the Jewish people on that night gave birth to the infamous reputation of this day as the 9th of Av, something which this Shabbat is the preparation for, then that means that the story of the spies and the tears that it led to, crocodile tears perhaps, are the basis or the beginning or the foundation or the blueprint for the destruction of the temple. And I want to understand why. What about the mistake of the spies gave birth to this, to the destruction of the temple, to the pain of the 9 days, to the mourning of the 3 weeks, to all of the individual pains that we feel at given times and specifically at this time? It's interesting to note, and I don't believe that this is by accident. I am sure that there are commentaries who describe this. I just haven't had a chance to look. The word chinam, atem bachitem b'chiya shel chinam, you cried vain tears, tears for no reason, has to remind us of that other famous saying that uses the same word. The Talmud tells us that the reason for the destruction of the temple is not because the Romans used, superior strategy. It's not because the Jewish people weren't prepared. It was because of something called Sinat Chinam. The first temple was destroyed because of specific transgressions, murder, idolatry. But the second temple, which is generally viewed by Jewish tradition as the much greater destruction because it lasted so much longer, the second destruction, which we are still recovering from, 2,000 years later, right, was because of Sinat Chinam. Now, most people translate Sinat Chinam as hatred for no reason, blind hatred, wanton hatred. And we've pointed out, I think once or twice in these discussions, that that doesn't make a lot of sense. What do you mean that hatred for no reason? And you're walking down the street, and you see a fellow, you've never met him before, and you decide you hate him. So that's ridiculous. Right? Who would hate someone if he doesn't know him? Right? We've spoken about in the past that the opposite of love is not hatred, that it's apathy. Right? So if I don't care for my fellow human being. So hatred, in a sick sort of way, at least demonstrates that you care about something. So you can't hate someone if you don't know who they are. You must have a reason to hate them. Otherwise, that's not hatred, it's psychotic. So the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, the son-in-law of Rav Chaim Volozhin, in the mid to late 1800s, suggests that Sinat Chinam, blind hatred, is when you hate someone simply because their opinions are different from yours. Right? Somebody has a different opinion, you disagree with them. Sometimes you need to disagree with someone's opinion. Sometimes you need to act upon the fact that you disagree with their opinion. But if in the process you come to hate them, that's called Sinat Chinam. I gave a class last night, the Shiur, to an Israeli group actually in Tel Aviv. And just because we're feeling here at Israelite that it's time that we started to work with Israelis, there's so much to do in this country. And on the way back, coming out of Tel Aviv, I was with a student, and we decided to stop at Kikar Rabin. And I haven't been at Kikar Rabin when it's empty since before Rabin was assassinated, since Kikar Malchei Yisrael. Every time I go there, there's a big rally there. The last time I was there was, just before the disengagement. There were 250,000 people there. So it's been a long time since I was able to just walk in. So we stopped and we walked into the Kikar, largely empty, huge open square. And we went behind the stairs, behind the platform, below City Hall, which is where Rabin was actually shot. And there's a whole memorial there now. You know, it used to be just a pile of flowers. There's a whole memorial. Blind hatred. To hate someone because their opinion is different from yours. That is the seed of the destruction of the temple. right? And it's interesting then that there must be a relationship between the story of the spies and that for no reason tears and the blind hatred that the Talmud says is the cause of the destruction of the temple. What is that connection? So it's interesting. What really was the mistake of the spies? There are a lot of different opinions. And we once spoke about, and I'll share it with you again, an idea that comes from the Lubavitcher Rebbe in his Likutei Sichot, which I think is a very powerful idea. You know, that there are certain questions about the sin of the spies that don't make a lot of sense. For example, if you were going to make a case, the 10 spies come back, and they say, Lo nuchal, we can't do it. Efes ki hazaham, the people, it's true that it's a land of milk and honey, it's true it's a wonderful land, but the people are strong, and the cities that they're in are fortified, right? And we are like grasshoppers, we're not ready for this. Lo nuchal, look, we can't go up. So Kalev ben Yefune, one of the two spies who disagrees, stands up and says, Alon alev agam nuchal, we can do this. And when you look at what he says and what Yeshua says, let us take the land that God has commanded us to take, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because if you were going to make an argument, if you were going to make a case for why it is that the Jewish people can go in and conquer the land, you would think that the most persuasive, the most convincing, the most cogent argument would be the miracles. Like, why doesn't Kalev ben Yefune say, well, hello, I mean, the splitting of the sea? Doesn't even mention it. And where are Moses and Aaron? Where are Moshe and Aaron? Moshe and Aaron just fall to their faces. They have nothing to say, which is even more unbelievable. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe suggests the issue here was not that the spies did not believe that God could take them into the land of Israel. That's ridiculous. This is a generation that saw the splitting of the sea. They saw the 10 plagues. These were Nisim. They were princes of men. They were greater than the greatest Torah scholars of today. Their issue wasn't that they didn't believe God could conquer the land. Their issue was precisely that they knew that he could. They understood that they were living in the most unique experience in human history. They were studying in the greatest yeshiva, the greatest school of Jewish learning ever created. The Rosh Yeshiva were Moses and Aaron, Moshe and Aaron. They got manna from heaven, and clouds of glory surrounded them. They were in the presence of God. They were re-experiencing on a certain level the Garden of Eden. And their question was, how can we leave this? How can we leave yeshiva and go into the land? There was an instinctive understanding, perhaps it was a tradition, that when they would go into the land of Israel, they would absolutely begin to lose the miracles. The land of Israel is not about God doing it for us. The land of Israel is all about doing it ourselves. It's the place where the Jewish people come into their own. It's the place where the Jewish people begin to discover who they're meant to be. It's a place where we become partners with God in creating our own destiny. Powerful things. And the spies were basically saying, we're not ready for that. We have this enormous opportunity to learn in yeshiva, to hear Torah from Aaron, to bask in the presence of Moshe. We just got out of Egypt. We're still slaves at heart. Let's spend some more years in the desert yeshiva. Now, if that's the issue, you know, look, I want you to know, we live in a society today that struggles with this question. Go to the army, go to yeshiva. There are tens of thousands of boys in this country who do not go to basic training. They do not sweat up and down sand dunes. They do not carry a rifle. They do not put their lives on the line of defense of this country. They break their backs over the tractate of Sanhedrin and Yevamot. They sweat over the Talmudic debates in Kedushin. They sit in yeshivot and they study Torah. And I want you to know, as much as you can imagine, I have a different opinion on the matter. I can respect where that's coming from. For 2,000 years, we kept the dream of a Jewish people in the land of Israel alive, not because we had an army, but because we had boys learning Torah. Because families sat around their Shabbat table and studied Torah. Because Jewish children went to sleep with their mothers whispering the Aleph Beis and the lessons of the ethics of the fathers, Pirkei Avos, in their ears. And on the other hand, there are boys who say, if God's given us a country and there's a mitzvah to be willing to defend the Jewish people against those who would destroy us, we have an obligation to serve in the army, and that's a difficulty that we have to this day. These spies were rendering a decision. And their opinion was, right now, we need to be in yeshiva. We need to be sitting and learning Torah. We'll get to that. And that, by the way, is why there was no point in mentioning the miracles. Because the miracles weren't a cogent argument, because they were precisely the issue. If Kalev would have said, how can you not trust God who split the sea? They would answer, the splitting the sea is exactly the point. Why would we want to leave this environment? And that's why Moshe and Aaron don't say anything, because they're part of the problem. Imagine Moshe stands up and offers such a great discussion and debate on why they should enter the land. The spies can then say, this is what we don't want to leave, because they understood that they were leaving Moshe behind. So the sin of the spies represents the unwillingness to leave the environment of Torah, the safety of being close to God, the certainty that you're in God's hands and that life follows that path, the spiritual energy of being in such an intense place. And the reason that became known as the sin, the mistake of the spies, was because the baby doesn't want to be born. Life in the womb is good, and Judaism says the baby has to be born. The Jewish people have to be willing to step out of their tents of Torah. They have to be willing to cross over the Jordan River. They have to be willing to take the gun in their hands, as painful and as difficult as it may be. They have to be willing to build this land, bucket of dirt by bucket of dirt, painful advance by painful advance. And in those tears, on the night of the sin of the spies, was the destruction of the temple born. Why is it that I can think about this? Why is it that I can have Sinat Chinam? Why is it that I can hate someone else just because their views are different from mine? It's because I don't know who they are. It's because I stay in my own four cubits, I sit in my yeshuv in my town, or I pray in my own synagogue. You can't really hate someone like that when you get to know them. You can only hate someone like that when they're just an opinion. And I want you to know, if there is an audience in this country that represents the ability to bridge those gaps, to break down those barriers, it's the soldiers in the army. At no time in my life, in my experience, have I had more contact with more different types of people, more different types of Jews, and by the way, even non-Jews, than when I was in the Israeli army. When you're charging up a hill, there's no left wing or right wing, there's no Arab or Jew, it's all just one. Such a powerful experience. And I have to tell you, the tears of the sin of the spies became the tears of Tisha B'Av, because we didn't learn the lesson. We have to be willing to put away our talis sometimes, to put the tefillin inside the bag, to put the prayer book in our pocket, and to be partners in some of the most difficult enterprises the Jewish people have been involved in our history. And maybe that's why this week's portion, Ela HaDvarim, is related to this question. You know, it's interesting. We wrote about this week in the Parsha Bite, so you can take a look at this. But in verse 9, there's a very powerful verse. Moshe is going through a description of all the things that happened to the Jewish people, and many of them are very difficult. And he's giving them what's known as tochacha, is reprove for the things that have happened in the past. Very difficult why he's doing this and what that means and what it means to critique someone else, and is it done out of love? And, you know, those of you who are curious, you can send us an email, because we wrote a Parsha Bite about that. But he says at one point, V'almar alechem, and I say unto you, ba'et ahi, in that time, lemo, lo uchal levadi se'et atchem, I cannot alone carry you. It's a very difficult line. Moshe says to the Jewish people, I cannot carry you. Can't do it. And you kind of wonder, why is Moshe saying that? Well, what a horrible thing to say. And he's talking here in this book. This week is on the banks of the Jordan River. He's speaking to the second generation. He's speaking to those boys. He's looking into their eyes. He's standing in Gush Etzion, talking to the Hezdernikim, to the yeshiva boys who he knows are going into the army. He's talking to the boys of Eli, the year before army, Mechina Kedam Tzvait, an institute that prepares boys with Torah and with running in the mornings and at night to go into the army. He's looking into their eyes and he's saying, I know you're about to cross over the Jordan River. I'm going to tell you the history of your people. And he has to tell them, I want you to know, in that time, in dealing with your parents, Lo Chal, I wasn't able to carry them, Seit Etchem. Why is he telling this to the second generation? And the Medrash, Rashi actually quotes this. says, this makes no sense. What, Moshe, who split the sea? Moshe was the vehicle for God bringing the 10 plagues. God couldn't work it out that Moshe could carry the load. He couldn't. In fact, what it's discussing there is that he used to sit from morning until night and listen to the pain of the Jewish people. They would bring him their court cases, their litigations, their issues, and he would sit from morning till night, and he couldn't do it anymore, so they set up a system of judges. So what, Moshe couldn't do it? Moshe, who was up on Mount Sinai for 40 days without food and water, he couldn't do it. So Rashi points out, it's not that he couldn't do it, it's that Hashem didn't want him to do it. It's not that I can't, it's that God has told me, I must not, lo uchal, I cannot do. Even if I would want to, I can't do it, because this load needs to be shared. Understand that the reason that Israeli boys across the country are heading up north now, understand that the reason that hundreds, that thousands of our best and brightest kids wearing green uniforms are in very dangerous places is not because God needs them. It's not because God couldn't do it on his own. It's because we need to be willing to carry this load together. That's part of how we're meant to become who we are. And that is our challenge on this Shabbat of Dvarim. It's interesting that the Devar means a word, ledaber, to speak, but it also means a thing. Just like the Ten Commandments, which are 10 things. The words this week are almost tangible. You can feel them. They rip into your gut. And I guess I bless all of us that this Shabbat, on Friday night, against the light of the Shabbat candles, as the sounds of Lecha Dodi waft in through the synagogues, wherever you are, wherever we are, there are a lot of families with empty chairs. There are a lot of brothers who will never get to put their arms around their older brother. Fiancés who will never get to walk down to the chuppah with the one they loved. Parents who will never get to walk into the room. You know, my cousin Danny. So they got up from Shiva this morning. And they went to the grave and they came back. And he says to one of my other relatives, he says, I got a room full of Benji stuff. What am I going to do with it? Can you imagine how painful it is to go into the room of a young guy who was just beginning his life and have to decide what to do with it? I met a woman who lost her son. And she told me the saddest part of the whole experience, that at least after he had passed away, she wouldn't wash his army uniforms. She could still smell him in them. It's a unique smell that only a mother knows that you can't find anywhere else. And eventually, the smell just dissipated. And it was the last tangible piece of her son in this world. And she sat down one Saturday night next to a box full of her son's stuff with his army uniforms in her hand. And she began to sob because she realized that she would never get to hold him again. Such a painful week for so many of us. So whoever you are out there and wherever you are, I bless us all that we should have the opportunity over the coming days to feel more oneness. If sinat chinam, hatred for no reason, hatred because we can't stand people with different opinions, if that's how the temple got destroyed, and make no mistake about it, every human being is what's called in rabbinic legend the Mikdash Mat. We lost the temple all over again last Thursday afternoon. And we've lost many Batei Mikdash and many temples. And if all of that comes as a result because we hate each other, because we can't stand each other's opinions, then says Rav Kook, the third temple, that time of peace that we so long for, will be rebuilt because of Ahavat Chinam. Because of love for no reason. And if hatred for no reason, as the Netziv says, and by the way, Rav Kook was a student of the Netziv. Rav Kook studied in Valazhin, and the Netziv was his Rosh Yeshiva. So I have to imagine that Rav Kook knew very, very well this idea. And Rav Kook suggests that the next temple will be rebuilt through Ahavat Chinam, love for no reason. That means that you meet someone whose opinion is completely different from your own, of whom you are convinced he's wrong, and maybe his opinion is destroying the world, and you figure out how to love him despite his opinion, and maybe even for the fact that he has a different opinion. And that is a very tangible thing that we can do. Everybody talks about peace. We have to have peace. Everybody talks about unity. You know what your challenge is this week, and this Shabbat, and during this difficult period? Be vehicles for the creation of Jewish unity. Find one person You don't have to find 100 people, and you don't have to put on an army uniform if you're sitting in Scarsdale or West Hartford or whatever it is. Find one person, one fellow Jew, because that's where we can start, who has a very different opinion, and figure out how to fall in love with them. And you will create one more piece of Jewish unity. And if we would all start to do this, the world would change with us. So I wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.